Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Well, the first is the idea of black insanity. I picked this up from William A. Smith. William A. Smith argues that black men, in their engagement with racism and white supremacist notions of the world, have a very specific experience of racism, a very specific male experience of racism, which he calls black misandry. And what I liked about William's work, Smith's work, is that he says, like, look, like black misogyny are an aversion to black women. Black misandry exists to justify and reproduce the subordination and oppression of black males while concomitantly erecting edifices of racial and gender inequality. In my work, I've expanded this idea. What I've wanted to talk about, because I'm tracing this over centuries, is how these are cumulative assertions of hyperpersonality traits, how hypersexuality, hypermasculinity, these things accumulate around black men as a group to justify the sanctioning and extinguishing of their lives. Notice how this is, in fact, a way to theoretically articulate what social dominance theories have already pointed out. That if you're looking at white supremacist patriarchal societies, the people who are going to be targeted to protect white society, culturally, and biologically are racialized men. But then what's the phenomenological essence of that experience? What term captures that? What they're experiencing over and over and over again, right? Anti-black misandry does that work for them. So throughout the text, what I'm trying to do is figure out this problem. That if we assume that the subordinate male target hypothesis is true, well then how do we frame this within the discussion, the articulation, the analysis, and description of black men's experiences from the 19th century forward? So the book is a catalog of black men's experiences from slavery to the present day. What I'm most interested in chapter one is precisely this problem of how black men as an outgroup somehow always both want to imitate white men, right? This idea that, well, black men's quest for freedom is merely trying to be like the white man, but still seem to always fall short. So it's like I said, if black men are patriarchs, they have to be the dumbest patriarchs in the history of the world because they never seem to acquire any kind of power to determine their own lives or the lives of others. And this becomes especially important when you're discussing the rise of feminism and suffrage in the 18th century, or the 19th century, I'm sorry, because what we find is that suffrage was not an argument about equality to black men. It was an argument waged by white feminists to become equal to white men at the expense of black men. And here's what I mean by that. Throughout the book, I catalog the debates that white feminists were having around suffrage. The argument was not, the language of equality doesn't appear once, but what does appear is the ability to rule. That white women, because they're more educated, because they're more civilized, because they're more evolved, should be able to rule over black men because they're still savages. And when you're looking at Elizabeth Cady Stanton, when you're looking at, you know, Charlotte Gilman, when you're looking at, you know, even Jay Adams, what you find is this insistence that white women's natural place is as a colonizer and imperialist next to white men. Well, then how does that change how we interpret that moment where black men became free? My suggestion is that the moment of freedom, freedom birthed the rapist. Because this was the caricature that white feminism used to justify white men killing the outgroup male as a lethal biological and cultural threat. So when Rebecca Latimer Felton says, we want to stop the rape of white women, kill 1,000, lynch 1,000 Negroes a week, if need be, she is appealing to this same outgroup sentiment of the 19th century that is building from white feminism the idea of empire and a union between the groups.
Context of White Supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, November 8th, 2018. So I have been told. This is our second study session on Dr. Tommy J. Curry's The Man Knot, Race, Class, Genre, and Dilemmas of Black Manhood. We just started the book last week. If you missed it, the first session is in the archives, and we only got to the introduction. In fact, we didn't even finish the introduction from last week, so we'll finish that up this week and get into chapter one. The audio that we heard at the beginning of the segment this week, that was from a talk that Dr. Curry just gave a few days back. One of our listeners had the opportunity to hear both Dr. Curry and Dr. Charles Mills, who also was a guest on The Cows. We talked about his book, The Racial Contract. Dr. Curry speaks highly of Dr. Mills' work on a regular basis, but he was able to send me the audio. Obviously, you heard Dr. Curry talking about the man knot and some of the very topics we will address in the book today. We have our list. If you have questions, things you don't understand, masculinity is one that was on the list from last week. We'll get back to that. But any other questions, if things aren't explained well, let us know. Dr. Curry is aware that we are reading his work. I'm sure he would be willing to help out as we proceed. Without further ado, this is Dr. Tommy J. Curry's The Man Knot, Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number one. Academic theory has a passion for black male mimeticism, so much so that it is analytic, a property of black maleness itself. This position is little more than a myth disproved by the attitudinal studies on black men since the mid-1980s. In reality, 30 years worth of data validates Staples' analysis in the 1970s that black males simply do not share the same definitions or hold the same cultural expectations as white men in America. Black males are socialized to understand manhood in the context of their vulnerability, the dangers their assertiveness and competitiveness are perceived to have in the larger society. Black men define manhood based not on their ability to dominate others, but rather on their vulnerability to America's racist, misandrist regimes. Claude Franklin writes, "Many black male youth also learn that a lacuna exists between those traits of dominance and competitiveness internalized and their exhibition in the larger society. They are very much aware of the high rate of black male unemployment, black male underrepresentation in high-paying, high-prestige occupations, and the generally inferior status of black males in American society. It is only within black subculture or interpersonal relationships that black males can even express a masculine role, so their idea of black manhood is quite distant from the dominant white society. In fact, some studies have found that black males' conceptualization of manhood does not include any reference to the ideas of white masculinity." Andrea G. Hunter and James E. Davis's Constructing Gender, An Exploration of Afro-American Men's Conceptualization of Manhood, asked one question to a group of black men in New York. "What do you think it means to be a man?" The answers and clusters of ideas revealed that discussions of masculinity were absent from the men's definitions of manhood. Hunter and James explained that this difference in black male perceptions of masculinity and manhood possibly reflects a cultural awareness of the difference between the physical sexual man and the social man, a distinction first introduced in Nathan and Julia Hare's Bringing the Black Boy to Manhood in 1985. The Hares maintain that black boys understand the social man as a moral and jural condition which extends or should far beyond the trappings and execution of committed sexuality. Whereas masculinity was thought of as a reflection of the dominant culture, aggression, power, and so on, for black males, manhood emerged as a multidimensional construct that defines being a man in terms of the self, a man's relationship and responsibility to family, and a worldview or existential philosophy. Manhood was the idea black men used to frame how they thought of themselves outside the ills and stereotypes of mainstream society, and allowed a distinction between what they saw as masculine, white behavior and the behavior of a black man. As Hunter and Davis explain, although masculinity may be a part of being a man, it is not the foundation on which manhood rests. The long disproven racist stereotype that holds black men to be misogynist and natural threats to women remains the starting point for many conversations concerning black males. Contrary to these ascriptions, black men and boys have consistently demonstrated that their subordinate racial male position has made them more aware of sexual oppression and gender inequality. In 1983, Noel A. Casnave asked if all black men suffer from the double bind, or being expected to fulfill traditional masculine roles while being denied manhood because of their race. His study found middle-class black men, those black males thought to embrace the ideals of hegemonic masculinity most readily, to have more progressive gender attitudes than white men, to approve of non-traditional roles for women, women's issues, and egalitarian marital relationships, and to believe that men can learn a great deal from the way women act that can be incorporated into their own behavior. In 1989, Ruby Lee Gooley's study of race and gender consciousness among black Americans found that the mean race and gender consciousness levels of black women are more similar to the mean levels for black men than to those for white women. While the early 1990s marked the popularization of intersectionality and the presumed gender consciousness of black bodies based on their biological designation as male or female, multiple empirical studies confirmed the findings of the previous decade, maintaining that black men were certainly more aware of, if not more conscious of, gender inequality than other men and women. For instance, in 1995, Kathleen Blee and Ann Tickemeyer's Racial Differences in Men's Attitudes About Women's Gender Roles used national longitudinal survey cohorts from 1960 to 1981 to test the attitudes and racial concepts of gender between white men and black men. Although the study used data collected as long as 30 years before Hunter and Davis's study, it found that African American and white men differ in their attitudes about women's gender roles, that beliefs about gender roles change across time, and that individual status and life course processes influence gender role attitudes. because black males are socialized to see women as earners in the home, they have far more equitable ideas of women's labor than white males and see black women as co-workers needed for the economic survival of the whole. These attitudinal differences are not simply isolated to how black men see black women. They reflect a much deeper understanding of how sexual oppression operates in relation to racism. Andrea Hunter and Cheryl Sellers, Feminist Attitudes Among African American Women and Men, published in 1998, attempted to respond to assertions about black men's beliefs about gender with empirical findings. They were very perceptive in noting, despite the body of work on African American women and feminist thought, there have been few empirical investigations or theoretical discussions of feminist ideology or consciousness among black men. Hunter and Sellers' study sought to measure three issues they believed were central to feminism. 1. Recognition and critique of gender inequality. 2. Egalitarian gender roles. 3. Political activism for the rights of women. Similar to previous studies, Hunter and Sellers' study found that African American women and men tended to have similar positions on the feminist issues examined. In addition, Hunter and Sellers observed African American men are often cast as having few positive, proactive, adaptive strategies to handle the crisis associated with a diminished primary provider role. Their analysis shows that black men's experiences with police brutality and unemployment may facilitate a recognition of the importance of both women and men inside and outside the home, particularly in difficult times. Hence, one response to a threatened male breadwinner role is a shift in gender role attitudes. Evelyn Simeon's Black Feminist Voices in Politics uses the National Black Election Studies, the National Black Politics Study, and her own National Black Feminist Study to document the broad support black men have for women's issues. Simeon's work dispels the common mythology insisting that black feminist commitments are fundamentally tied to a black and female identity. According to Simeon, black women and men recognize that the problems of racism, poverty, and sexual discrimination are all linked together. Black feminists are beneficial to the black community. Black women should share equally in the political leadership. Black women should take on a more prominent role in the black church, and the overwhelming majority of respondents, black men and women, felt that they share a common fate with black women. What is perhaps the most controversial aspect of Simeon's work is that her studies have found that black men are equally, and in some cases, more likely than black women to support black feminism. In a subsequent article, A Black Gender Gap, Simeon updates her findings, concluding that black men and women share the idea of intersecting oppressions and linked fates. Simeon writes, "The present study provides additional evidence to support the claim that African American men have truly progressed in their thinking about traditional gender roles and have supported black feminist tenets for longer than many realize. African American women are similarly supportive of black feminist tenets, but to a lesser extent than African American men." Several years later, Catherine Harneau used Simeon's National Black Feminist Study to test Patricia Hill Collins' theory of standpoint epistemology. According to Collins, a black woman's standpoint is defined as those experiences and ideas shared by African American women that provide a unique angle of vision on self, community, and society. Harnois's work, like Simeon's, found that Black men are as likely, and in many cases, more likely, to support the values such as the interconnectedness of race, class, and gender, and political behavior traditionally thought to belong solely to a Black feminist orientation. Harnois found that Black men are supportive of Black women's leadership roles in politics and have supported gender equality more wholeheartedly than any other group of men and more than some women. Contrary to the purported correctness of standpoint epistemology, gender simply does not control the political sentiment or limit the social consciousness of Black males. Black men experience the world alongside Black women. They, like Black women, are abused because of their race and sex, yet theory holds that because they are not women, their awareness of gender inequality cannot be due to their maleness. So while Black women's gender progressivism originates in their outsider position, it is suggested that Black men's progressive gender attitudes cannot originate from theirs. These are ideological assertions based on the imagined history of Black maleness as privileged and normative rather than an account of the particular disadvantages that make racialized maleness an outsider positionality in white patriarchal societies and the possible origin of a Black male genre theory. Because of their peculiar subordinate racial sexual position, Black males are able to understand the complexities of social life much better than the academic theories allegedly designed for the same end. Today, the deployment of contemporary gender theories, such as intersectionality and hegemonic masculinity, assume long disproven myths concerning Black male socialization and political aspiration. Many of the aforementioned empirical studies sought to test the attitudes and worldviews of Black males as a way to address the historical caricatures of Black men as jealous aspirants craving white male power and dominion. These empirical studies capture what has long been denied to Black males in theory, a reflective capacity. Because of their marginalization and oppression, Black men have developed a separate historical consciousness of manhood that is quite distinct from that of white masculinity. Instead of facilitating an exclusive cognizance of their own oppression in terms of race, Black males have explained their oppression consistently formulated in terms sensitive to their peculiar sexual oppression, their particular vulnerabilities as Black males who are unemployed, hunted, and discriminated against. Black men feel empathy for women's sexual oppression beyond the presumed racial register because they experience the world as economically, sexually, and politically endangered. In other words, Black males are empathetic because the economic and political obstacles they face are simultaneously experienced in the world as racial and sexual vulnerabilities. Despite these findings, many scholars, both Black and white, male and female, will continue to assert that generally Black males are sexist, misogynist, and patriarchal. These stereotypes not only function to condemn and dehumanize Black males, but they also give communality to the self-selected academic class who find intellectual and political unity in pathologizing them. When these long-disproven stereotypes are given the label of theory, the racist generalizations offer the illusion of specialization to the black men and women building their careers as experts on black masculinity and protects whites against charges of racism, since their hatred and fear of and discrimination against black males can be rationalized as theoretical advance. Unsurprisingly, the very same efforts that are morally praised as decentering black men, the denial of their death and poverty, the ridiculing of panels on these topics, the denial of venues for publication in the academy are condemned as racist when practiced in society. Like the racist rationalizations that justify stop and frisk, racial profiling, and black male death, black masculinity studies constructs black men as a threat to women and others, codifies such constructions through theory, and legitimizes the discrimination and isolation of black males throughout the academy based on the alleged physical danger they pose through their mere presence and supposed spatial threat they pose to others through their opinions. The need for a black male historiography. Resisting the mimetic imposition on black male history. The biological reduction of black masculinity to its sexual assignment of male, largely built on the vacating of the historical peculiarity of race and the consciousness black men have gained through centuries of racist colonial expression, allows all sorts of evils to be ahistorically ascribed to the aspirations of black manhood. The lack of rigorous study and non-fictive exploration of the black male's particular historical consciousness enables disciplines and theorists to erase the specific ontogeny of black manhood throughout the centuries, preferring his perceived sexual designation as male to serve as the foundation of his historical and contemporary psychology. This essentialism, this biologically determined percipience, is never questioned as currently applied to black males, despite a history in which the feminization of colonized men seems rather a gesture of humiliation, attributing to them sexual passivity under the threat of rape. Whereas black women are argued to have developed a historical consciousness and various strategies to deal with their marginality and sexual oppression, black men, even when shown to have been victims of rape, economic marginality, medical experimentation, cannibalism, and castration, are denied the capacity to engage reflectively and respond to these realities. Canonical gender theory asserts that black males only answer to their victimization even when at the hands of white patriarchy is, in fact, white patriarchy. How can one historically study black males who are denied humanity, man-nots, in a way that is not confined to colonial notions of gender? Chapter 1, On Mimesis and Men, aims to break the historiography of gender theory that maintains that the end of slavery marks the beginning of blacks' assimilation of bourgeois European gender norms as the path toward freedom. It shows that within 19th and 20th century blackness, there was a retreat from many of the foundational modes of gender in the West. A Historiography of Black Males, Chapter 1, articulates the breaks in the assumptions that black and maled bodies simply aspire to patriarchy. A tradition of black manhood is erected on the foundations of ethnology that was anti-imperial, anti-colonial, and consequently not patriarchal. Over the past decade, several works dedicated to exposing the colonial origin of gender have problematized our casting of gender, the theoretical deployments of masculine and feminine on black bodies. Derek Scott's extravagant objection, Blackness, Power, and Sexuality in the African American Literary Imagination, aims to capture the conditions of blackness and the intuitive capacities of the black abject prior to gender. For Scott, the abject marks gender in a state of relative undifferentiation, gender as, however momentarily, not yet defined. The abject denies gender differentiation within blackness. This deprivation imposed on bodies by blackness needs to show itself as not masculine. But this does not mean that it is necessarily feminine or only feminine, merely that it cannot be narrated except as the negation of what it exceeds or overruns. Scott marks an indeterminate being expressed as a negation or lacuna of gender itself. Abdul John Muhammad's conceptualization of racialized sexuality aims to ground a similar point regarding the formation of the gender concept within the history of racist violence in the United States. John Muhammad writes, "Within the confines of United States slave and Jim Crow societies, racialized sexuality exists at the point where the virtual powerlessness of certain subjects intersects with the massive prohibitive power of various state and civil apparatuses, power that, it must be emphasized, is always underwritten by the actual or potential use of massive coercive violence. Within repressive structures such as slavery or Jim Crow, black sexuality is configured in relation to the asymmetric power imposed by white bourgeois sexual mores. The black body, constrained by impending death, is unable to express a normative sexuality that is not shackled to the asymmetry between blackness and whiteness. The contingency of black sexuality, defined by the relation and will of the white subject in relation to which it is positioned, requires conceptualizing the sexuality of virtually powerless groups within a register that is completely different from the foundation of gender that is traditionally offered and is merely the anthropological template of bourgeois white culture. For black males, this nexus of negation is particularly affixed to their near zero degree of social conceptualization as flesh and death, their transition to meat. Contra Hortense Spiller's distinction between body and flesh as the poles of the captive and liberated subject, where flesh is prior to the gendered rules of the body that erase the history of violence committed on African female flesh beyond rape. John Muhammad suggests that insensate flesh, or meat, is an impending threat that conditions black maleness to accept castration as the barrenness of their life itself. Racialized castration is the force of maturation that transforms boys into men in John Muhammad's reading of Richard Wright's account of black masculinity. John Muhammad writes, racialized castration is not really concerned with managing the principle of substitutive equivalence on the register or signification or the symbolic as such, but rather on the register of political power and control. And it is on this register that racism attempts to negate the principle of substitutive equivalence between one citizen and another in their capacity as citizens by erecting a barrier on the basis of racial identity. And it is precisely the erecting of this barrier through the act of castration that constitutes the profoundly phallic and sexualized character of the racial border. In this context, a black boy can become a man only by understanding and accepting the prevailing structure of sexualized racial difference, which is to say, by accepting his social castration, failing which he will have to face the possibility of his literal castration. The threat of castration and the impending fatal force of death share in the origination of black manhood in the United States. Blackness distorts gender, making it inoperative on black bodies. This historical distortion consequently makes the extension of the gender category inapplicable to the condition of blackness and those sexed bodies within wretchedness or abjection. As the literary theorist Greg Thomas explains, there is no universal man socialized in opposition to a universal woman or vice versa. There is a white man and a white woman specied over and against black African slaves who may be described as male and female. We are not studying men when speaking of black males. We are studying negations of white man itself. Chapter 1 argues that theory must be able to explain the historical moments concerning the creation of race and the denial of gender for blacks in the 19th century. Chapter 2, Lost in a Kiss, takes up the question of mimesis from the opposite end of the spectrum through the analysis of a convicted rapist and nationalist named Eldridge Cleaver. In many academic circles, Eldridge Cleaver is the quintessential black macho. He is the rapist, the buck, and the narcissist terror of black women at large. But what if he was something else? What if Cleaver reveals that he was not simply a rapist, but a theorist of the erotics that preceded rape? The homoerotic production of black men as convicts, the nameless black male flesh that is sacrificed to the prison industrial complex? He was convicted of rape in 1958 and freed from prison for that crime in December 1966. It was after his release that he met Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale, who had founded the Black Panther Party on October 15 of that year. Cleaver's book, Soul on Ice, was not published until 1968, the same year he began teaching at the University of California, Berkeley. There is no justification for Cleaver's use of rape, but as scholars, we can try to understand his motivation and the pathologies involved in his decisions. To understand Cleaver, we must resist the present-day inclination to insinuate that his rape conviction, his time in the Black Panther Party, and his intellectual works were synonymous or simultaneous. Lost in a Kiss gives some context to the sexual violence black men historically experienced at the hands of white women and, in effect, white patriarchy during Jim Crow and well into the 1960s. By situating the rape of black men historically, I show that the convict criminal is a category endemic to black males that makes black males vulnerable to repetitive sexual repression, violence, and rape. Today, incarceration is thought of as a racist monument, a historically racist institution. Rarely is the prison thought of as a formative institution that produces specific kinds of beings, black male beings, in society. As a consequence, prison rape is thought to be simply the function of male attempts to dominate other men and not a means of producing these kinds of selves in the world through sexualization. Cleaver, however, argues for a very different conceptualization of rape in prison. Cleaver argues that black male sexuality is thought to be parasitically attached to the quest of black male politics and resistance against white supremacy. Cleaver traces the obsession with the criminalization of black male sexuality to slave revolts such as that of Nat Turner. Referring to William Styron's depiction of Nat Turner as the inevitable rapist of Emmeline Turner in The Confessions of Nat Turner, Cleaver asks, why do you think that white boy who wrote a book about Nat Turner turned Nat Turner into a freak? The basic lie of his book was about who Nat Turner wanted to fuck. Nat Turner killed white people, white bitches, and he killed four black people for black bitches. So who do you think he related to fucking? Who the black man is thought to lust after is the libidinal motivation behind all of his political acts. His defining impulse is thought to be rape. He pursues politics simply to gain the opportunity to rape more, to conquer black men and dissuade them from resisting white males. The prison was constructed as a homoerotic arena of surveillance and corporealization. The political resistance of the black male is criminalized as the extension of his brutish nature to rationalize this market. To contain his resistance, society creates notions of criminality affixed to the capacity of his black phallus. It produces him as undifferentiated black phallic flesh, able to be used or killed at the whim of white men and women. There are not individual black men or boys. There is only the black male. The prison simply stores these black male bodies for later use. Black male vulnerability as a foundation. Evaluating the political economy of black male erasures from theory. Black male vulnerability is the term I use to capture the disadvantages that black males endure compared with other groups. The erasure of black males' actual lived experience from theory, and the violence and death black males suffer in society. The term is not meant simply to express the material disadvantages black males face due to incarceration, unemployment, police brutality, homicide, domestic and sexual abuse throughout society, or their victimhood. The term is also meant to express the vulnerable condition, the sheer fungibility of the black male as a living terror, able to be killed, raped, or dehumanized at any moment, given the disposition of those who encounter him. Black male vulnerability is an attempt to capture the black male's perpetual susceptibility to the will of others, how he has no resistance to the imposition of others' fears and anxieties on him. Despite the contemporary intersectional, feminist, and liberal progressive framings of gender hierarchies that maintain that black men have some privilege based on their maleness, black men and boys lag behind on practically every population indicator from education and income to health and mortality. Classrooms are hostile environments for young black boys. They are often thought of as lazy, disruptive, and in need of the most discipline. Teachers routinely assert that black boys are less intelligent than whites and black girls and treat them less favorably as a result. Some scholars have even shown that parents have taken up the view that black boys are less academically gifted than black girls. These lower parental expectations for black boys academically leads to not only less parental involvement in their education, but also less reward or encouragement for their academic success. The negative experiences black boys endure from kindergarten through 12th grade have very real consequences for college and beyond. Since the dawn of the 21st century, black men have received fewer than 40% of the associate, professional, and doctoral degrees awarded to black Americans. The consequence of black males earning fewer bachelor's and doctoral degrees is reflected in the number of black male professors at Title IV institutions throughout the country. According to the most recent report by the American Association of University Professors, there are roughly 48,000 black male and about 70,000 black female professors at Title IV colleges or universities in the United States. Black female professors outnumber black male professors by a little more than 20,000. In contrast to the history of white Americans in higher education, black men have always been outnumbered by their female counterparts in college enrollment and degree attainment. As the demographer Ann McDaniel explains, the historical trend in college completion for blacks is not marked by the reversal of a gender gap that once favored males as it was for whites, but rather entails a long-standing female advantage. Similarly, the economist Rhonda Sharp notes, since 2000, black women earned twice as many associates, bachelor's, and master's degrees as black men and nearly twice as many professional and doctorate degrees. The growth of black women in the university has allowed them as a group to attain tenure-track employment at rates comparable to that of their non-black counterparts over the past two decades, while black males are still trying to gain sustainable access to colleges and universities at the baccalaureate level. The historical advantage of black women in education, first remarked on by W.E.B. Du Bois in 1927, brings attention to a stark race-sex inequality disregarded by many, if not most, scholars working on race and gender. If this gender gap in education continues, warns Wilma Henry, by 2097, all of the baccalaureate degrees earned by African Americans will be bestowed on African American women. The smaller number of black males pursuing college as a first choice drives many into labor-intensive, blue-collar occupations. While these jobs will offer some economic independence compared with those years spent in college, black males in these blue-collar occupations rarely climb the economic ladder into the middle class. This lack of class mobility for black males carries the risk of poverty and unemployment. Incarceration has also had a devastating impact on black males' lifelong economic prospects. At the end of 2009, an estimated 841,000 black men and 64,800 black women were in state or federal prisons and local jails. According to the Bureau of Justice reports on prisoners, on December 31, 2014, Black males had higher imprisonment rates than prisoners of other races or Hispanic origin within every age group. The economists Derek Neal and Armin Rick found that the growth of incarceration rates among Black men in recent decades, combined with the sharp drop in Black employment rates during the Great Recession, have left most Black men in a position relative to white men that is really no better than the position they occupied only a few years after the Civil Rights Act of 1965. The impact of incarceration is not simply rooted in the removal of these Black males from society. Incarceration also marks Black men for years after they are released, making employment and basic sustenance nearly impossible. Evelyn Patterson and Christopher Wildman's recent study, Mass Imprisonment and the Life Course Revisited, found that imprisonment has even more devastating effects on Black males' economic condition and quality of life than previously thought, since incarceration robs Black males of disproportionately more years that they are capable of working. Patterson and Wildman conclude the total amount of time Black men, on average, spend marked not in prison, but an ex-prisoner and felon, is far larger at 11.14 years, corresponding to roughly 27% of their working lives. This means that Black men spend, on average, 31%, roughly one-third of their working lives, either locked in a state prison or struggling to overcome the negative outcomes that result from their marked status. As Becky Pettit argues, high rates of incarceration among Black men and Black men with low levels of education in particular have profound implications for accounts of their social standing and that of their children, families, and communities where they live prior to and following incarceration. Incarceration, then, is more than simply an institution. It is a socially invigorated stigma that marks poor, uneducated Black males throughout their lives and is far too often related to their impending deaths. But what if society is so dangerous for Black men and boys that prison, despite its deleterious consequences, is preferable? Evelyn Patterson's Incarcerating Death, Mortality in U.S. State Correctional Facilities, 1985 to 1998, points out that Black men are actually safer in prison than in American society. She writes, for Black males at every age, death rates were higher for the population outside of prison compared with their same race counterparts in prison. What are scholars to make of this paradoxical social reality? Historically, the prison has been explained as an institution that deprives the criminal of freedom. Incarceration is thereby linked to slavery and America's history of racism by the extent to which Black men are criminalized and then made into prisoners, but rarely do these analyses explore the sexual aspects of imprisonment. As with our notions of racism and even American slavery, Black males are imagined only in terms of their confrontation with white male power, never in terms of their vulnerability to rape or sexual violence at the hands of white men and women. Regardless of race, we live in a culture that denies the vulnerability of men to rape in general. Rape, when it does happen to men, is thought to be perpetrated only by other men. Women are never thought of as rapists or as perpetrators of sexual violence. As Laura Stemple, Andrew Flores, and Ian Meyer explained, stereotypes about women reflect gender and heterosexist biases, include the notion that women are nurturing, submissive helpmates to men. The idea that women can be sexually manipulative, dominant, and even violent runs counter to these stereotypes. Yet studies have documented female perpetrated acts that span a wide spectrum of sexual abuse, which include even severe harms such as non-consensual oral sex, vaginal and anal penetration with a finger or object, and intercourse. Female perpetration of sexual violence does not occur in a vacuum. Female perpetrators are aware of the innocence attributed to femininity, and consequently, the protection being female offers them from being seen as perpetrators or sexual violence, especially in cases involving imprisoned Black males. Even with the change of the definition of rape by the Federal Bureau of Investigation from the carnal knowledge of a female forcibly and against her will to the penetration, no matter how slight, of the vagina or anus with any body part or object, or oral penetration by a sex organ of another person without the consent of the victim, there has been little change in the public's perception of male rape. As Stemple and Meyer explained, although the new definition reflects a more inclusive understanding of sexual victimization, it appears to still focus on the penetration of the victim, which excludes victims who were made to penetrate. Despite the change in the actual law, data collection still operates on the idea that males are perpetrators rather than victims of rape. Because male victims who are made to penetrate are classified under sexual victimization in FBI reports, the actual number of non-consensual sex acts forced on males is not classified as rape. This means that the number of males who are actually raped remains invisible not only to the public, but also to scholars reporting the data. Despite their prevalence, female perpetrators of rape remain unrecognized and under-theorized. According to Stemple and Meyer, the 12-month prevalence estimates of sexual victimization show that male victimization is underrepresented when victim penetration is the only form of non-consensual sex included in the definition of rape. The number of women who have been raped, 1,270,000, is nearly equivalent to the number of men who were made to penetrate, 1,267,000. The authors continue, "This striking finding that men and women reported similar rates of non-consensual sex in a 12-month period might have made for a newsworthy finding. Instead, the Centers for Disease Control's public presentation of these data emphasized female sexual victimization, thereby perhaps inadvertently confirming gender stereotypes about victimization. For example, in the first headline of the fact sheet aiming to summarize the National Intimate Partner and Sexual Violence Survey's findings, the CDC asserted women are disproportionately affected by sexual violence. Similarly, the fact sheet's first bullet point stated 1.3 million women were raped during the year preceding the survey. Because of the prioritization of rape, the fact sheet failed to note that a similar number of men reported non-consensual sex. They were made to penetrate. Such definitions serve as the cultural foundation for how we understand rape generally throughout society, but perhaps even more consequential is the role these definitions play in the disregard for rape in prisons. This heteronormative lens, which limits rape and the desire to rape to the power of men over women has severely overdetermined how scholars have come to understand incarceration and blinded many to the history of sexual violence and rape that occurs within the prison. Prisons are routinely excluded from household crime surveys. Thus, prisoners who are frequently victimized by staff and other prisoners are not considered in various publicly reported measures of rape and sexual coercion. Currently, prison rape discourse focuses almost exclusively on sexual abuse perpetrated by men. The popular notion is that prisoners rape prisoners, when in reality significant numbers of staff, both male and female, are reported to rape inmates. The dominant perception is that male staff rape female inmates. In reality, however, we find varying expressions of rape that are not only homosexual, but are also heterosexual and perpetrated by women. Even when the Bureau of Justice Statistics found that 69% of male prisoners report sexual misconduct by female perpetrators, the impact and trauma caused by such victimization is de-emphasized and made to conform with traditional gendered assumptions about sex, specifically who can be the victim in forced sexual interactions. This denial is particularly worrisome for our knowledge of incarceration and its effects on Black males. As Kim Buchanan explains, the notion that Black male criminals stigmatized inside and outside prison as hypermasculine rapists might be sexually abused by law-enforcing women contravenes every intuition race and gender stereotypes have to offer. As such, scholars are blind to white men's homoerotic coercion of Black men and willfully deny that Black males are victims of white women's sexual power and violence within the prison. Multiple social scientists are alerting scholars to the incompleteness of information we have about Black males to understand their disadvantages in health, income, and mortality because of policing and incarceration. Meanwhile, scholars in English, women's and gender studies, and various assortments of liberal arts assert not only that we have enough knowledge about Black men to justify not studying them, but also that our present knowledge of Black males is complete and uncontestable. These scholars hold that Black men have an enduring ontological advantage over Black women because they are male, despite the aforementioned disadvantages they have in relation not only to whites, but to Black women as well. These realities, facts, so to speak, are unmoving to theorists since a moral righteousness is asserted in de-emphasizing Black male vulnerability. Chapter 3, The Political Economy of Niggerdom, examines this phenomenon as a function of political economy, although it may be the case that the erasure of Black males from disciplines may be the function of somewhat metaphysical rather than ideological structures of thought. While an analysis of the super predator, domestic and sexual violence, and the presumption of Black males as only perpetrators and not victims of violence may expose the limitations of academic scholarship, the consequence of such an examination may entail confronting the reality that Black maleness is cemented semiotically and thereby ontologically as a category of death and disregard within the symbolic order of America. Context of white supremacy. That is the end of audio segment number one. We will pick up, we're on the subtitle, The Death of Black Men, The Race-Sex Nexus of Black Male Existence. That is the subtitle. We are still in the introduction we will wrap that up and move to chapter one in the second audio segment. But that's where we are. If you have comments, questions, the number to dial, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. If you think folks would benefit from hearing Dr. Tommy Curry's The Man Not Share links, let folks know that The Cows is broadcasting. You can always listen live at blacktalkradionetwork.com. Just click the tab for The Cows on the page and you'll be able to listen live there. You can go to our page at TuneIn. Just go to TuneIn. You can search for The Cows or do a search for TuneIn and The Cows, and that will pop up. I tweeted that as well. You can also always dial in the number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Before I get to the folks who called in, first, I wish the great Joe Morgan was reading The Man Not. If folks recall, Joe Morgan did the audio for The Invisible Man, Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, my favorite book all time. He did the audio. He's been in lots of different works, including Terminator 2, the black character. But I wish he was reading it. Unfortunately, we don't even have the poor man's Joe Morgan. We have Gus T doing the narration. I hope you all can bear with me. It is not an easy book to read. Woo! But bear with us. The other thought, out of many important portions of the text this week, where he says, and I have the ebook version, so, you know, pages might not correspond, but the portion where he says Evelyn Patterson's incarcerating death, mortality in U.S. state correctional facilities 1985 to 1998 points out that black men are actually safer in prison than in American society. She writes, for black males at every age, death rates were higher for the population outside of prison compared with their same race counterparts in prison. What do we make of such a presentation, such a statement? The footnote is presented if folks are incredulous and would like more data, I can provide the footnote as well. But would definitely like to hear thoughts from folks who read and or heard that from Dr. Curry. Wow. We'll get to folks who dialed in. Hope people are adjusting. The new time for the book club, no longer on Fridays. Thursdays now with the book club. Fridays, neutralizing workplace racism. I'm still adjusting myself. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I bear it?
Yes, sir.
All right, greetings. This is Henry from Chicago. On page 23, when he says, because black males are socialized to see women as earners in the home, they have far more equitable ideas of women's labor than white males and see black women as co-workers needed for an economic survival for the whole. Well, this basically goes to the fact that, you know, black people have the highest unemployment rates for I don't know how long. I mean, as long as they've been keeping Department of Labor statistics, and basically black men have been at the top of that chart. So this is why we, you know, we see this the statement that Dr. Curry had mentioned here. On page, bottom of page 24 and then part of 25, he says, many of the aforementioned empirical studies sought to test the attitudes and worldviews of black males as a way to address the historical characters of black men as jealous aspirants craving white male power and domination. The thing is that we as black males don't crave white male domination or white male power. We are just trying to survive in the system of white supremacy. So that is the case with that. Page 27 at the bottom, when he talks about the racial castration, you know, I thought about the interview you did with Dr. Dunn last week in regards to when he was talking about the difference of, you know, when they, you know, the very few white people that were lynched and then all the black people that were lynched, how when black people were lynched, they were castrated. And the white, you know, the few white people he claimed that they were, that were lynched, were not castrated. So I thought about that that racial, you know, castration. And one last thing, bottom of page 29, despite the contemporary intersectional feminist and liberal progressive framings of gender hierarchies that maintain the black men have some privilege based on their maleness, black men and boys lag behind on particularly every population indicator, from education and income to health and mortality. And that goes to show you those who believe that, you know, that black males have some sort of privilege due to black male privilege. That last statement of, you know, being at the bottom of every population indicator is basically proof that there is no such thing as black male privilege. That's all I'll have for now. If I have some more, but I'll let somebody talk. I'll be my mind.
Caping for black males. Thank you, sir. Incidentally, Dr. Dunn was on the program yesterday. It is in the archives at SoundCloud and Black Talk Radio Network. We revisited the election where black male Andrew Gillum took an L, although it looks like they might be doing a recount, but he did already concede and the white man is moving forward, taking office. I cannot imagine in the state of Florida something happening where Mr. Gillum, this black male, becomes governor after all this. But anywho, other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary, line should be open. Proceed.
Hi, I'm Gus.
Greetings, Ivy.
Greetings, Gus. I just wanted to say real quick, I'm actually going to hang up and call right back in because there's a lot of choppiness in my line, and I want to see if that fixes it. So if you can, even though you don't have your own back, if you can have my back and look for me on the switchboard, I'm going to call right back.
Got your back, Sister Ivy. Yes, ma'am.
All right, brother. Bye.
Yes, ma'am. The hate you give, the hate you give. Other folks that dialed in that we've not heard from, if you have commentary, if you have a hand up, line should be open. The other folks that have a hand up, or is everyone waiting to get their notes together? Or
can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, how's it going, Jeff?
Right, poorly.
This is Black Male Engineer. I got this book probably about a year and a half ago, and I went through it very thorough, especially the introduction. And what I found interesting was, you know, his talks on stuff like hegemonic masculinity and how pretty much black men were never viewed as masculine, ever. Even when the white man first came to Africa, he never viewed us as masculine. And, you know, so the fact that now black men get called toxic masculine is you know, it's just ahistorical. Today, there was a live stream of this show called The Grapevine with so-called millennials to talk about certain issues. And the topic was, is there a war on masculinity? And pretty much the conversation was what I thought it would be and what Dr. Curry talks about all the time. It's a bunch of women. It's a bunch of homosexuals, quote unquote, trying to explain what it means to be masculine to men and saying, this is why who you are is wrong. And there was one guy in there who started talking about, like, you know, how black men were never viewed to be masculine, how, you know, the men are in the homes, but the domestic violence hasn't gone down. And, you know, he just started throwing facts and figures. And I could tell he actually read Dr. Curry's book because he was putting out a lot of Dr. Curry's arguments. And I thought that was great because this show gets watched by like 50,000, 100,000 people, you know, at a time per episode. So, yeah, that's pretty much it.
Lots of that very popular, as Dr. Curry talks about in this book, theories or anyone taking the position that, yes, you have toxic black masculinity of some sort that needs to be corrected, caged, killed. Very, very popular on many platforms. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary, proceed.
Thanks, Jess, for having my back. Is there any distortion in the line? Am I breaking up at all?
Not so far.
Okay, well, greetings to you and greetings to all the callers on the line. There was a statement in the book about that black boys are seen as lazy and unruly and in need of severe discipline. I don't think they're not seen as that. They are propagated as that to justify harming them, to justify funneling them into special ed and putting handcuffs on them and arresting them and just sterilizing them. The stats that he cited on just black men being raped in and out of prison, I mean, I just thought it was astounding. I mean, that was just incredible, and I look forward to actually going back and listening to this again tomorrow or as soon as it's up, so that I could go and check out those stats, because that is just horrendous. And the interesting thing is that it's not really surprising, because, you know, they want to propagate this lie of sexism to deflect from racism. So, of course, they're going to lie about and downplay the victimization of men, and especially of black men. To answer your question as to why it may be that black men are safer in prison and incarcerated than outside, it could be the fact that, I mean, I don't know. I'm just thinking that the thing that came to my mind is that in prison and in places where, like in prison and in jail, there's guards everywhere and, you know, everybody's under security and all of that. And so, like, for an example, if a black man pushed a white man because that white man, he was terrorizing a black woman, like what happened, I believe, in Florida, in prison you wouldn't be able to just jump up and just shoot that man to death like that, like he did, because that's another thing. Your weapons are also confiscated in there. And I just want to make a statement also about what the last caller just said about this nonsense about, or this propaganda really, about toxic masculinity. What that's about is they just want to erase gender, because they want to get as many people as they can to be homosexuals for people control, known as population control. And they really want to demonize and want to get rid of black masculinity, because they want to control black people most of all. And so, yeah, I think that was it. And I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
Much obliged, Ivy. Greetings, Thomas in New York.
Greetings, Gus. If you were going to say something, I'll mute myself.
Nope, just calling out other folks who dialed in.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to all the callers. Not a fan of Black Scholars or Black Scholarship, but he's doing a very good job of, explaining the problem in a very complicated way. White male patriarchy. I think that he did a great job in what I got out of what he was saying was as Black males, we're not really just in a white male patriarchy system because we're also under white woman matriarchy. They have the same level of power over us. White males, of course, being at their white men being at their males, they have a lot more physical stature, you know, and things of that. So they're able to have a certain status over their women. But their women, even with their smaller stature, even the biggest, you know, Black person, they have a certain level of power over because they're white. So you really get it from both ways. So I think that calling us Black males until we fix this problem is right on point because in the system of white supremacy, we don't even have power over our own women. You know, it's we have no power over anyone. Either way, man, Gus, I had to get into a physical altercation with a white person today. I will discuss that tomorrow. Workplace racism, still kind of heated. I don't think that to one of the gentlemen who said who spoke earlier. I do think that Black men crave white men's power. I think that just listening to hip hop or what you call today modern day rap, you know, you hear that. All of the people, I'm gonna get this, do this, so I can, you know, style on these dudes, and you know that's all exuding. Even the Black male toxicness. That's all us mimicking white males trying to do what they do. I think even if you look at the lore of Black males to not only hip-hop but sports, in particular basketball and football, because there's a certain level of Black male patriarchy while still maintaining the white male patriarchy system and dominance. You know, the Black males are in charge in those areas. You know, it's two or three female rappers out at a time with hundreds of male rappers, you know. Look at the NBA, the NFL, of course. And I think that that's one of the things that we're looking at. And we see Black men with the appearance that they have power, like white people, even though white people are still in charge, you know. Either way, that's what I think. I got the impression from the listening to the reading and Gus, you're doing a great job, of course, that Black women are doing much better. Well, one of the first impressions I got is that somehow schooling is the answer, and I don't think that would solve the problem, even if we had more Dr. Currys. Definitely, I don't think that would solve the problem. And Black women are doing better because of educational level, which is true, but I think that there's certain levels of opportunity that white people are giving to Black females that aren't given to Black males that is causing that. That's all I wanted to say, Gus. Thank you.
Other folks who dialed in that we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary, proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, greeting callers, listeners, and Gus, again, thank you for the platform. Great read so far. It's great that this is, I mean, it's amazing we're still in the introduction, by the way. But I did want to comment on the fact that classrooms, I forgot what page it was. I have it written down in my notes, but classrooms tend to be a violent, I'm not sure if that was the correct word, but a difficult place for Black males. Henceforth, earlier on, it stated that to basically get some type of validity or some kind of masculinity, Black men tend to retreat to the quote-unquote underworld or Black market. So that's where most of Black males end up retreating to. And it's noticeable. My son is dealing with the same issue as well, where in school it's a very hostile environment where they're constantly, I don't know if it's a metaphor, it's a metaphor nonetheless, but picking at him at every instance they get, thinking that he needs more discipline and needs to be corrected in more harsher terms and ways than other children, even if he's outperforming them on tests. So I could understand how in the prison system is pretty much the next avenue where a lot of Black men end up. My question is, though, is it really a scenario where that we, I mean, and this goes on actually something that Thomas just mentioned, is it really, do we really need to have more Black men in schools in order to be successful and to achieve a certain level of financial stability? Because I still have the thought in my mind that even if that occurs, if we still end up pointing our Black men in towards the direction of schools or institutions that are white dominated, we'd still have the same issues just with smarter individuals in those places. And like Carter G. Woodson, we may end up with a lot of miseducated Black men in that process. I think that we have to eventually find ways to educate our own in a unique form in a manner that's more constructive, more productive for us at overall. That being said, I thank you for your time, and I'll mute my line.
Much obliged. Can anyone point to like a specific sentence that states or suggests that we need more Dr. Currys, or we need to get more Black people in school so that they can be financially successful? Can anyone picture that, particularly in the introduction, since that's the only part that we've covered? If anyone can point to a specific sentence where they get that type of sentiment, that would be helpful. Others that we've not heard from at all, if you have a comment, question, or something that, you know, stood out from the book that you want to speak to, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter in Florida.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, everyone. I brought up the word masculinity, and I think I basically have been hearing some clearer understandings of what that word means and how to apply it in thought and or action. It primarily is stating about the characteristics, for the most part, physical characteristics of the male species. It's not always exclusive with males, masculinity I'm talking about, especially under a global system of racism, white supremacy. The races are very scientific, especially with their victims, on confusing the behavior and or characteristics to where it's hard to see a dividing line between masculinity and femininity in a lot of cases. But I have been hearing some more clearer understandings of what that means. The global system of racism, white supremacy, the effects that it has amongst non-white people, especially non-white people who are racially classified as black males, it limits, of course, anything associated with being a quote-unquote man. And therefore, because they understand through their scientific research and study in the most incorrect way, that the results is going to be that the victim is going to compensate for not having a healthy understanding based on the mistreatment, and start compensating in ways that are not to their personal and collective best interests, such as, like Mr. Fuller says, strutting around with muscles, you know, that sort of thing, and that's basically would be understood as a quote unquote man type of thing, as far as a misinterpretation of what it actually is supposed to be, it's going to be paramount that non-white people, especially non-white black people collectively, are going to have to go about the means of solving the problem of racism and white supremacy, of course. And then we're going to have to rebuild on what it means to be a man and a woman, as far as that's concerned, based on all of these many centuries of damage that's been done to people on the planet. And those are my thoughts right now. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter in Florida. Others that we've not heard from, my apologies, so many things I'm hosting. I'm a victim. Thomas in New York, hope you are safe and taking care. We will look forward to workplace racism tomorrow, to getting the update on what happens. The violence abounds in the system. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary.
Hey, how you doing? I'll yield for the lady.
Much obliged.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, this is Technically Speaking, calling from Atlanta, Georgia. First, I just want to take time to thank you so much, Gus, for the show. As always, it's very constructive. And I'm really glad that Mr. Curry is doing this type of work of documenting who black men are and continue the work of other black sociologists and academics like Dr. Welsing and different people, showing, you know, documenting who we are as a people. And I was so upset about the fact that we are always looked at through the lens of white, that about a year ago I wrote a paper myself about the misrepresentation of the black family. And it reminded me of what Mr. Curry said. I could only catch a sentence because I'm listening. And he said that what white men or white people put forth about the black man is really them studying the negation of the white male. Or basically, I saw that statement as dismissing the pathology of white. And when I was studying for the paper that I was writing about the misrepresentation of the black family, I studied a book by Harriet Pipes McAdoo, where she made a statement. It's called Black Families. And she said that the Black family or Black family life has been held hostage by white dominated thinking. And I think that it's good that Mr. Curry is doing this work, because we are all held hostage in this global system of racism, white supremacy, in my opinion, by white dominated thought that is really a negation of white pathology. And every time they carry on a study or whatnot, because I remember you had a show about the need for more Black scientists, and I can't remember the scientist's name who was on the show, but he talked about that need being so important because the way that white people view the universe.
We kind of deviated from the book a little bit. That is something I'm a stickler about on the book club, is being on specifically on topic with the book.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry, I didn't mean to go off topic. I thought I was staying on topic based on just the idea of him presenting the Black male image as it really should be seen, as opposed to how white people present not only the Black male image, but every aspect of who we are. And I spoke about the scientist because Mr. Curry seems to be illuminating his thought about the need for more Black people to put forth these viewpoints, because when white people put forth a viewpoint about Black males or Black people, it's always based on this, what he said in the book, this negation of white people or white pathology, instead of really illuminating.
I want to pause because okay. You quoted that twice, and that's not the quote. Mm-hmm. And that is a okay. very important quote. The quote is, I'm actually going to give the full paragraph so you all have context. This historical distortion consequently makes the extension of the gender category inapplicable to the condition of Blackness and those sexed bodies within wretchedness or abjection. As the literary theorist Greg Thomas explains, there is no universal man socialized in opposition to a universal woman, or vice versa. There is a white man and a white woman speciated over and against Black African slaves, who may be described as male and female. We are not studying men when speaking of Black males. We are studying negations of white man itself. The quote, when he mentions negation, it's talking not about the negation of white pathology. It's talking about Black males specifically. They're Black males, the very definition being the negation of manhood. And manhood, as we understand it, is white manhood. That really being what it means to be a Black male, the negation of manhood. That's what he meant in that sentence, which is not what you were saying.
I'm sorry, it doesn't seem like I'm making myself clear. I think I did understand that, but maybe I just need to listen a little further. My notes, or maybe my understanding of what's happening, is unclear. I can mute my line.
For sure. And this is a book, I think I did say last week, this is probably one, it would be great to have the book with you, because it's such a detailed and complex text. And I certainly do not consider myself to be an expert, but that's one where it's like, yeah, I would want to be specific to the exact sentence to try to make sure that I'm not misinterpreting or trying to be as close as possible to what he actually meant, what he actually said in the text. So yeah, that would probably be very, very helpful for us to all have the text and just striving to be accurate with, you know, understanding what's being processed. It's a lot to just listen and capture. Other folks who dialed in that we've not heard from, if you have comments.
Hey, how you doing, Gus? This is Victim out of New Jersey. I'm coming in kind of late. Hopefully I can catch more of the reading. But from what I gathered from last week, do you have any suggestions? This Saturday, I'm deprogramming a young black female, mainly by the age of 13, 14. She read a book that y'all previously went over, The Hate That You Give, and I'm using Dr. Kelly's book to kind of like give this young, or who's my cousin, younger cousin, give her a better perspective of what it means to be a black male in this country, because there's a word that you just basically added to my vocabulary, black Lysandra. And I mean, that's perfect. So I introduced that word in context of the book, The Hate You Give. And also, so what my question is, do you think this book will be a little bit too hard for her to read on her own?
Cause I'm, yeah, absolutely. I'm, Saturday, I'm,
okay.
Absolutely.
Okay,
I think it's hard for me to read on my, own.
But I wanted to use some of Dr. Curry's talking points this Saturday, because when I talked to the young female, and everything that you could imagine that a young black female would come, that would gather from reading The Hate You Give, that is that's basically was being basically regurgitated out of her mouth. You know, it's nothing but black misandry. So I just really want to talk to her, deprogram her. So I'll buy the book, but I think I would just mainly have to, as I send her these recordings, I think I would just have to basically debrief her. Also, I have to learn some of these words myself, because you're right, it is a hard read. But did you think that this book will be a great step to get a young black female to really understand what's going on as it relates to black males in this country?
No, I don't think this book would help. If we're talking, when you say young black female in this context, someone who's 13, 15, no, I think it would be way too difficult for them to grasp. But I do think, since you can read the book, and get, you know, a dictionary and whatever help, email Dr. Curry if you have a question, which we should all do. You can read the book and take away some of those talking points. She maybe could listen to the archive of The Hate You Give. Like, you could pick out some of those episodes, the conclusion or what have you. Or you could just distill it. You know, you could simplify some of the main points that Dr. Curry started with. What did he say? I see dead black bodies. I am sure she's 13, Tamir Rice, Trayvon Martin, Eric Garner, black males. You could kind of distill some of these points and relay Dr. Curry's message on a level that she can understand it. You don't even have to use the concept of black misandry to just kind of get the point across. And you can speak from your personal experience, just as a black male. You've lived as a black male for some years. You can talk about that, and even encourage her to talk to some of her other black male family members about their experience and how they're treated. And she could even reflect herself on how black males that she's, if she's 13, you said she's a young teen, I'm sure she's got a good decade of being alive with her eyes open and aware of, you know, racism, white supremacy. Children are not ignorant at all. I'm sure she's...
Well, I'm sorry, Gus. No, if I can interject. I mean, you're 100% right, because it's nothing that I fear with my younger cousin, because she's at her school.
I don't want to detour. Same thing that I told the previous caller. This is the book club, not the, you know...
Right. No, but you're right. She's still, she's learning a lot, and she's aware of racism and white supremacy. I'll definitely go the route that you mentioned, but I still want her to listen to some of these audio book read of The Man Not as well.
Oh, right on. That's awesome. That's awesome. You can help her out and see if she has any questions. Yeah, let's help her out, see if she has any questions. Anybody else that we missed completely have thoughts, comments, questions? We nabbed everybody. Grand. Just making sure, again, I am not an expert. I hope it doesn't sound like I am, you know, talking down to anyone and their perspective on the text. Certainly, we all have our own views and interpretations, but I did. Our caller, technically speaking, our caller who dialed in, I believe, the Georgia area. The only reason I did make a comment there was I do think that that is an important sentence where he's talking about the negation of Black manhood. And it didn't seem like that was being expressed explicitly as it was written. So certainly not talking down anyone about the text. I am not an expert. I am a victim of racism myself and needed a dictionary to get through the text a second time, reading it here. Some of the notes that stood out from what we read today. Let's see. I didn't really hear very much commentary about the statistic about prisons and at all age groups, Black males having longer life expectancy in greater confinement as opposed to being outside. I thought that was, it was a stifling moment in the read. Like most of the time, if I'm narrating for a text, I do not highlight as I'm narrating. I will wait and highlight when we actually are reading the text for the book club. That was one of the very few times that I stopped and highlighted immediately when I read that statistic and that line in the book. Just wow, like that is how grueling the system of racism, white supremacy is. Like wow. I'm still having to think on that one, and that will top of my list the next time that we have Dr. Curry on the program to make sure that I ask him about that specifically. Let's see, I thought this was important as well, because where you have all of this talk about toxic Black masculinity and the problem of Black males, he writes that talking about your young cousin, many Black male youth also learned that a lacuna, that was when I had to look up, a vacuum, a void, a lacuna, come on, exists between those traits of dominance and competitiveness internalized and their exhibition in the larger society. They are very much aware of the high rate of Black male unemployment, Black male underrepresentation in high paying jobs, high prestige occupations, and generally inferior status of Black males in American society. It is only within Black subculture or interpersonal relationships that Black males can even express a masculine, and he put it in quotes, I thought of retired firefighter, role, so their idea of Black manhood is quite distant from that of the dominant white society. I thought that was extremely important in talking about how even young people notice this from a very early age, and that impacts even how they're thinking about what manhood, presumably womanhood as well, what that would even mean in the system of racism. And incidentally, since we're talking about limited subcultures, to me, it does not make logical sense. And some of this would come back to what we mean when we say patriarchy. I think it was articulated that Black males perhaps express some level of patriarchy in professional sports and hip hop. These are all, as all areas of people activity, dominated by racist man, racist woman, racist child. I'm not aware of Black people being in charge of anything in professional sports. And I do not accept those examples as these are supposed to be representative of Black males in some way, because these are such small, and I even feel like that is overstating it. These are such diminutive examples, groups of individuals. I mean, that's less than 1% of the population is professional athlete or a hip hopper. So I don't think that that is even valid evidence. If we're going to be having a serious talk about black males or black people in general, and our example is hip hop music, like, I don't accept that. And again, it would still come back to what we mean when we say patriarchy, even if that is accepted. Anywho, back to the text. Continuing right in the same paragraph, it said the answers and clusters of ideals when they were getting their data from black males reporting revealed that discussions of masculinity were absent from men's definitions of manhood. Fascinating, I thought. Continuing, where it talked about black males being empathetic about issues of sexism. I found that interesting because I've heard many, many times over the years, a decade of broadcasting, so many times that is not the case, that black males are not empathetic. That's one of the first programs that we did, that black males are not empathetic and don't listen to the concerns that black females have or are not receptive to the problems that they experience in a system of racism, white supremacy, and having data that says that that is not the case, not always the case, certainly. Let's see. I thought this was great where he says, like the racist rationalizations that justify stop and frisk, racial profiling, and black male death, black masculinity studies constructs black men as a threat to women and others, codifies such constructions through theory, and legitimizes the discrimination and isolation of black males throughout the academy based on the alleged physical danger they pose through their mere presence and supposed spatial threat they pose to others through their opinions. I thought that was great because I do hear a lot of that. In fact, I remember just before the cows began or came back on the air in 2009, I called into a program that was a book discussion on tragic arrangements, specifically black females with white men. And I called in to address racism. And I remember a caller before me called in and posed a question. I don't remember. It was somehow that incorporated black males, and they got so, I don't want to say violently, but it was a very aggressive retaliation. Like, we are not talking about black males' issues, and that dominates the discussion anyway. And we are having our own separate dialogue that doesn't have anything to do with that black male nonsense. Like, this is archived. I could go back and find it. This is would be the autumn of 2008, about 10 years ago, roughly. But there's quite a bit of that I've experienced in saying that, hey, black males are overrepresented anyway, and we're tired of talking about them. We're going to talk about other issues now. Let's see. Next, already got that one. I thought the disparity in the number of black males and black females at the university level was extremely important. I'll read what he says. It's not in the portion that I highlighted, but I've heard, we've had guests on this program who have talked about the concept of black male privilege. And even how can such a concept come out of the academies where you have that small number of black males? And at the same time, they do all this talk about patriarchy and sexism where you have that huge number of white women. I so appreciated his data and just breaking down the exact numbers of folks who are at the collegiate Ivy, well, not just Ivy League, but at the collegiate level, talking about the academies. And I mean, why that just stood out as being so flagrant to me, because I hear that, I've heard people say that as though black males are taking over. And it's just, you know, the few black people that are at the professors I'm talking about that are at the collegiate level are black males. And, you know, they get to publish all their scholarship and get tenure. And him saying that that is not the case, that under the system of white supremacy, racists have allowed a significantly higher number of black females to be there, and what that means even for scholarship and where the focus of research is going to be. I thought that was really important. I will pause there. Did any other folks have comments, questions that they wanted to make sure they get to before we get to the second audio segment?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I think you totally misrepresented what I was saying. If you go back and listen, I think you'll get the point I was making. Last week we said that I don't think this book is written for black people, and you said you agreed. Who would you recommend this book to? Because I believe Red in Ohio says all the time, when we have a white guest, who's more confused, black people or white people? And we all know that black people are more confused. It just, would you recommend this to a confused victim?
I mean, a confused victim, I don't know what I would recommend. I mean, you know, how confused are we talking and that sort of thing. I mean, yeah, it would really depend on how confused we're talking and how comfortable they are with reading. That's another thing that's important, because sometimes when I talk to victims and they are not comfortable, they don't do a lot of reading. Obviously, I would not suggest a book like this to someone who is not interested in doing a lot of reading.
Would you recommend this to a confused victim who has a doctorate degree?
Again, same thing I just said. It would depend. If they're confused, how confused are we talking about? I mean, yeah, I would have to see how that's represented. It varies a lot depending on the person. Are they married to a white person? Like, what level of confusion are we talking about?
Gotcha. No problem. Would you recommend Dr. Wells's book to a confused Wells?
Same thing.
No problem. All right.
Other folks that had a comment, question. I did add the caveat. The cows did get a shout out in this text. So I certainly cannot say that's what I said last week. I certainly wouldn't say that there was no intention for non-white people reading this text. I certainly wouldn't say that at all. How did we get a shout out? And incidentally, the audio clip that I played, I said listeners or a listener heard Dr. Curry give a talk within the last few days. There is a introduction to that talk where Dr. Curry talks about specifically writing this book for black people. And I almost played it for the introduction this week, because I remember we talked, Thomas in New York asked that question last week. I almost played it for the introduction, but he specifically, I don't remember if he was asked or if that was a part of the setup. And it seemed that it was a lot of black people present. I know the listener who was there was one, and it seemed like at least one of Dr. Curry's friends was there who did Dr. Curry's introduction for this event. And it seemed like it was a room full of black people, but he was saying that he wrote this book specifically for black people. And he talked specifically about the problem of writing with the intention of writing for black people and from a black perspective, where you're not apologizing. It was like 5 minutes long. He gave this explanation about what it means and writing where you're apologizing for white people and talking about them being ignorant and all of this. And when you do not take that perspective, and it was really detailed, and him saying that, yeah, this, he definitely did not write this book for white people. Other folks who dialed in or even have a thought, folks disagree, think.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, Gus, Black Male Engineer. On to Thomas's question on, was the book made for black people or white people? You know, I pretty much read the book, and it was definitely made for black people in mind. And I know Dr. Curry said himself that he went out of his way to quote black people. Like, the whole theory of this book is based on what black people have said about themselves. He's using that to discredit like white theory and ideas, you know, using black theory. So I think it was made for black people. It's just the wording is so quote unquote intellectual that you can tell he made it for black people to combat like white intellectuals, you know? So that's just how I feel.
Interesting. That'll be one to ask for sure when we get him back on the program. Other folks, any? Oh, yes, would be like one other person. We have one other person that has a comment that they would like to share before we get to the second audio segment.
Will be here?
Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to quickly say, sounds to me like it's for just academics, just period, of any group, especially those who are propagating a lot of these lies that he's combating. And as far as like Dr. Weldon's work, the difference I would say with his stuff, like the lay person of any group, especially I would say Black people, because we're the least educated, or at least that's what it seems, that white people are intent on doing that to us, that we will really struggle with this book. Whereas like Dr. Welding's book, I thought that her book is extremely intellectual as well, just like Michelle Alexander. But if you kind of keep reading over the sentences over and over, I think you can like get through them a lot faster. Whereas this one, I think it just would be such a taxing struggle. But that was it. I made my mind. Thanks, guys.
That's an interesting comparison. The first book that we started on the book club was Yorugu, Dr. Marimba Ani. That is not an easy read either. I think many of the folks who were with us, or who, even if you weren't, if you have read that book or attempt to read it, I think I would get a for sure amen. That is not an easy book to read. With that said, we will get to the second audio segment. The Man Knot, Dr. Tommy J. Curry. We are picking up. We're still in the introduction, but we are almost done with the intro. Moving on to chapter one, The Death of Black Men, the Race, Sex, Nexus of Black Male Existence. Audio segment number two, Context of White Supremacy. The Death of Black Men, the Race, Sex, Nexus of Black Male Existence. In not being man, there is a negation of the humanity and personhood of the black male. Man-notness names the vulnerability that black men and boys have to having their selves substituted, determined by the fears and desires of other individuals. The black male stands in relation to others as always vulnerable, because his personhood, who he actually is to himself, is not only denied but also negated by society. Social contact is perilous, as the nature of the black male is overdetermined by the encounter he has with other individuals, or the power others have to define him when they encounter his body. He is denied sociality because every encounter a black male has with others holds the potential for accusation. In a racist society, the black male body has a logic all its own. Merely seeing the body of the black male differentiates it from that of a white man, humanity, and separates it in kind from the phylogeny of the human. The black male is defined by this distance to man, his nature being replaced with that of the brute and savage. He is made into horror. He literally is met with death. The effect of disposability and fungibility, because in the minds of others who see him, he represents death. He is imagined to be their greatest fear, in need of extermination. This terror is not solely racial antipathy. It also includes a very real sexual appetency. The lust, the libidinal desire for the black male's body that serves as the motivation behind his condemnation and death is not altogether new. Frantz Fanon argued in Black Skin, White Masks
that the nigrophobic woman is, in fact, nothing but a putative sexual partner, just as the nigrophobic man is a repressed homosexual. Fanon is clear that the substance of his analysis is not the Negro in general, but specifically the black male, since he refers to the homoerotic nature of the white man's desire for black men. This is important for understanding the implication of Fanon's assertion that, in relation to the Negro, everything takes place on the genital level. This sexual dimension of violence is therefore a substantial intervention into our categorical assumptions about race. Fanon is arguing that in racism toward the black male, there is a psychosexual oppression, a death-driving fear that stimulates the sexual desires of white men and women. Or, as Fanon says, when a white man hates black men, he is not yielding to a feeling of impotence or of a sexual inferiority. Since his ideal is an infinite virility, is there not a phenomenon of diminution in relation to the Negro, who is viewed as a penis symbol? Is the lynching of the Negro not a sexual revenge? We know how much of sexuality there is in all cruelties, tortures, beatings. The satiricism that motivates what black males are substituted for in the minds of white men has consistently received less attention than it perhaps has deserved. While the nymphomania of the white woman is suggested as the basis of her heterosexual obsession with the black phallus, the homoerotic manifestations of anti-black racism, the disgust toward but lust for the black male body, are rarely theorized as fundamentally linked to the violence black men and boys suffer. Chapter 4, Eschatological Dilemmas, diagnoses the satiricism that manifests as the homoerotic for a more accurate diagnosis of this problem, the drives and erotic motivations behind white society's desire for black male death. What needs are satisfied by killing the black male? Looking upon his corpse. Black men are rarely thought of beyond their dead bodies. What makes them that? The corpse is relatively unknown. The cause of their death is thought to simply be racism, and rarely proceeds beyond literally stating this. The process by which black male life is lost is inconsequential to theory, so to speak. This chapter names this problem. But when confronting academic theory's current preference for speaking of black men only as their corpses, we are forced to engage the very real and unshakable bias the numerous deaths of black men and boys imprint on our conceptualizations of the black male. Because he is literally absent, non-existent, dead, he is not thought to need new theoretical accounts. In short, his existence is thought to be fully accounted for within our pre-existing theories, despite the incompatibility these theories have with his actual life and his specific embodying of black manhood. Death seems to seek out the black body, indiscernible as human. The death of black men and boys has become so normalized in our society that it is expected. It is part of the social order of policing, white vigilantism, and the presumed outcome of a black man's involvement with whites, specifically white women. The dead black male body is so common that we are not shocked by seeing it lying in a pool of blood like Michael Brown, or found hanging from trees like Frederick Jermaine Carter. Black male death, despite its horror and gruesomeness, is tolerated within America. Whereas the violation of other bodies is thought to be too unsightly to be seen, the dead bodies of black males are circulated, shared, and memed with little hesitation. Many in our society accepted this reality as a norm, but what effect does death have on the lives, the mental concept of the self that black males formulate in this violent world? How do black males regard the future in a world that is so limited by the present? To be a black male is to live in constant fear of being accused of some offense against another. Black men live in a world where any accusation against them is thought to be evidence of their guilt. Imagine a world in which any individual who can be thought of as a victim of a black male has the power to define him as a criminal. This is the world many black males find themselves imprisoned within, too often defined by the accusations of others against them rather than their actual character. Take the case of David Owens. In 2012, he was stopped by police officers as he returned home from a long day working at New York's flagship Macy's store. The officers demanded his identification, then began arresting him. Despite multiple pleas, the officers refused to tell David Owens why he was being arrested, that is, until they walked him to a hysterical and possibly intoxicated white woman who identified him as the black man with a hoodie who stole her backpack. Although he had no previous criminal record, a time clock receipt showed he was at work, and he provided the phone number of his supervisor to corroborate his story. He was arrested and served 6 weeks imprisoned at Rikers Island. In some cases, black men are locked away without trial. 2 years earlier, Khalif Browder was arrested for allegedly stealing a backpack. He was imprisoned at Rikers Island for 3 years without trial. For more than 2 years, Browder was held in solitary confinement. Although he was a minor, he was routinely brutalized, beaten, and starved by guards. Browder emerged from prison a broken man and suicidal. He made his first failed attempt at suicide in November 2013. His second in June 2015 was successful. What possibility for life do black males have when they are reduced to their bodies and determined to be little more than the fear elicited in others? Chapter 5, In the Fiat of Dreams, tries to make sense of this problem. Our present conceptualization of black maleness lacks an account of the vulnerability the black male has in relation with others. As a phobogenic entity, the black male is liable for the anxiety other individuals experience, whether they are white or black, male or female. He is culpable for the violence these groups imagine, for their delusions as if they are actual. This shared neurosis often leads to the rationalization of black male death in America. In April 2015, the New York Times ran a story reporting that 1.5 million black men were missing in comparison with black women aged 25 to 54 from daily life due to death and incarceration. This report resurrected charges that America is deliberately and indiscriminately enacting a program of genocide against black men and boys. But what it did not include was that black males between 18 and 24 suffer homicide victimization rates double those of black men aged 25 to 34. Imagine being a young black male and knowing that you belong to a group where in your prime age years, years usually associated with thriving and growth, you may not survive. How does one feel knowing that homicide and imprisonment define the transition from boyhood to manhood? The violence that black males suffer at the hands of police, the prison industrial complex, and other Black Americans in impoverished neighborhoods creates an extraordinary psychological burden that is too often ignored in academic literature. Society continues to pretend that, because it remains so normalized or inconsequential in the minds of others, the death of Black men has no effect on the mental health of Black males generally. Black boys are committing suicide at rates much higher than in previous decades and than their Black female counterparts, while poor and unemployed adult Black men consistently report higher numbers of daily encounters with racism and depression than Black women. Witnessing other bodies who look like you slaughtered in the streets, seeing young Black boys executed and broadcast for the world to see, observing the continuing extinguishing of the life, the people that are Black and male have real consequences. The present theories offered to explain Black male identity, such as intersectionality, have no explanation for the grotesque, for the disproportionate death and dying of the Black male, the display of his corpse. Chapter 5 theorizes Black males as subordinate males in a white patriarchal society targeted for their racialized sexual relation to white males. By historicizing the increased rates of suicide among Black males, as well as their selective targeting in America, I seek a new formulation of ethics to promote a true understanding of the conditions antecedent to their death. I argue that rather than the rhetorics of shaming that focuses on Black males as problems, deviants within society, we need a paradigmatic analysis of the world the Black male endures, a viewing of the world that exposes its brutish reality and effects on Black males, even if this realization comes at the expense of the cherished hope many theorists insist should serve as the foundation of inquiry into race. I suggest that anti-ethical thought is the only way for scholars and activists to move toward a more accurate study of Black men and boys, because it is only in the recognition of the incompatibility between Black male life and the supposed civility of American society that we truly understand how institutions, policies, and dehumanization function to concretize the cased status of Black men and boys, and by consequence, the larger Black community. Chapter 1, On Mimesis and Men, Toward a Historiography of the Man-Knot, or the Ethnological Origins of the Primal Rapist. To hell with the white man's burden. To hell with Kipling's verse. The Black man demands our attention. His condition is growing worse. Why lose sleep over his burden? All mortals have their share. The Black man's growing hardships are more than he can bear. Black men enter our theoretical purview through the stereotypes and anxieties produced within our own time, so the historical milieu from which they actually emerge and in which they live is thought ultimately to be irrelevant to the production of theory. The academic theorist fears the Black males represented in our present day, so it is easy to rationalize these phobias, which interpret Black men as patriarchal, violent, and indifferent to the suffering of others, as method. Making one's phobias a historically salient feature of the world lends objectivity to the subjective, so establishing these stereotypes as antecedents legitimizes Black masculinity as theory rather than as theorists' pathology. Why do our imaginings of black males from slavery to the present day begin with these associations. Despite their origins in America beginning alongside the black female slave, black males are thought to reproduce and desire rather than resist and disown the white patriarchy of American empire. But what account or reading of history justifies this perspective? What motivates the scholar to interpret all political activity by black men as their attempts to mimic the white male patriarch instead of their efforts to redefine, recreate, and reconfigure black manhood? The demand to recognize race and gender as central to black women's historical struggles was accompanied by the power not only to define the black female subject, but also to insist on her motivations and her aims. The black male subject, however, has no such power. Scholars investigating black manhood are not only denied the ability to assert that black males do not, in fact, conform to white masculinity, but also condemned for suggesting that black men do not, in fact, aim for the semblance, given their distance from gender, man, human. Under the current paradigm, black males are theorized as only mimetic entities incapable of reflectively challenging white patriarchal social roles. Oyorinke Oyewumi's The Invention of Women problematized how the biological body functions in the epistemology and, consequently, the historiography of gender throughout the West. While Oyewumi's rendering of Yoruba culture has been both acclaimed and criticized, her analysis of gender has served as a crucial intervention into feminist analysis, presuming not only that social position, but also social consciousness can be indicated by demarcating that which is masculine, male, and feminine, female. Oyewumi suggests that present conceptualizations of gender, although heralded as social constructionist analysis, are in fact biological interpretations of reality in which social identities are all interpreted through the prism of heritability. This body reasoning makes biological determinism the filter through which all knowledge about society is run. The body is the focal point of understanding the other, or that which is external to the self. It establishes knowledge about others through intuitions, somatological impressions connected with how one associates meaning with the biological form, the flesh of others. Said differently, the biological body tells one not only how to differentiate selves, but also the intentionality of the other's flesh. In her identification of the oscillation between the biological and the social, Oyewumi observes that social construction and biological determinism have been two sides of the same coin. She continues, the centrality of the body, two bodies on display, two sexes, two categories persistently viewed, one in relation to the other, is about the unwavering elaboration of the body as the site and cause of differences and hierarchies in society. Bodies become conceptual deployments within our explanations of social relations and the historical origins of inequality, instruments thought to capture complex and historical dynamics by one reference point elevated above the inexplicability of the material world. As Oyewumi writes, so long as the issue is difference and social hierarchy, then the body is constantly positioned, posed, exposed, and re-exposed as their cause. The body marks a peculiar conceptual space, dictating not only how one thinks about reality, but also what one perceives as the relations that constitute reality. Within this configuration, the black male is used as a caricature of opposition to that which is black, female, and feminist. Contrary to the dogmas of black masculinity, black manhood was a dynamic historical character that not only recognized the importance of black women to the racial project, an idea that simply was not controversial under 19th century ethnology, but also challenged white patriarchy's various manifestations as systems of economic oppression, programs of colonial imperialism, and doctrines of racial evolution. Our current studies of black men primarily focus on politics, meaning that black men are judged by the extent to which they included black women in organizations or leadership positions in the 19th and 20th centuries. Rooted in the identitarian logics of our present day, which concede knowledge about gender to the perspectives voiced by the bodies marked by gender, black men who lived centuries ago are held to post-integrationist standards of intersectional theories developed in the 1980s. Under this paradigm, black men are deemed sexist or non-sexist, patriarchal or progressive by the extent to which they mirror the attitudes of black women of their own time, not to their actual thoughts about white patriarchy and its systemic reverberations throughout the centuries. Whereas the purity and virtue of the 19th century Victorian white woman was dislodged by historicizing her position and participation within a racialized and capitalist American empire, today the myth of moral infallibility has been reestablished by a 21st century practice of combining race and gender categories such that the black woman has now replaced her 19th century predecessor as the transcendent feminine idol unaffected by her historical epic. Today, race and female sex establish the limit of the gender concept. Gender conceptually centers patriarchy as both origin and problem, while race indicates the degree to which subjects may exercise masculine power. In other words, the distinction between the man and the woman emerges when one conceptualizes systems of relation, inequities throughout history, and asymmetry between bodies as the problem of gender itself. Anything and anyone that stands in relation to outside woman, gender, now becomes condemnable for not being woman, gendered, female. As such, even those who are raced and excluded from white patriarchy historically become analytically patriarchal because they are designated to be man and thereby defined outside of woman. Overdetermined by the essentialism tying the biological marker of male to that which is patriarchal, current theories of gender assert that black males exist in a world of false consciousness that obstructs their ability to understand their position within patriarchal structures. Robbed of their historical vulnerability to rape, castration, and death due to the mark of maleness, black male figures are judged not by the rigor and depth of their understandings concerning patriarchy, but by the extent to which they mirror the scholarly interpretation of the women in their day. This chapter argues that the black male stands outside this gender origin not because of his race, but because of his maleness. Because the black male is often defined by a categorical redundancy of him as male, his sexual difference, his genre, is usually obscured from sight. He is thought to be like the white male because he is biologically male. The notion of a different historical consciousness or development of manliness is thought to be conceptually impossible and without historical substantiation, not because there is no actual evidence, but because the proof is imperceptible under the present categorical assortment of knowledge. This historicization of the black male does not solidify another race-gender standpoint. In actual point of fact, there is no oppression that is unique in the sense that oppression happens to only one group of people within history. The study of the black male shows that certain kinds of violence accumulate around certain bodies, and these are the discoveries of his specificity revealed by study. Closer attention to black males throughout history shows that patriarchy is not an insular and gender-opposing system that protects all men while subjugating all women. Patriarchy stands apositionally to femininity as a self-regenerative system, both ideologically and biologically. It depends on white womanhood to enact its domestic terrorism and global imperialism. Patriarchy depends on white femininity for its propagation. Just as man and his expression of masculinity have meaning within Western patriarchal logics, so too are the female and her feminism the representation of the wombs that birth the masculinity of this order. Patriarchy evolved to protect white womanhood because white womanhood is not only the foundation on which empire is built, but also the nascence of the expendable white male surplus needed for imperial conquest. She births man, so the white woman is given a peculiar power under white supremacy. This reality is excluded from theory in an effort to maintain the essential category of the woman as morally good and subjectively vulnerable and in need of recognition and preference in discourse. In fact, it was the newly won freedom of black men that launched the theorization of our modern concept of gender. Their freedom inspired ethnologists and feminists to give accounts of femininity that were vulnerable to male violence. It was ultimately the threat of black male citizenship that gave substance to our current concept of gender in whites. Under 19th century ethnological schemes, black men and women were of a different evolutionary stock of beings. Gender did not exist because of their blackness. This racial gender ontology, thought to be apparent in nature and observable by science, could not produce men and women like those of white civilization, and it is from here, that place in history, that black men strove against the imperial reach of white masculinity and white femininity. This chapter indicts the idea that black men were gendered throughout history in such a way that they could share in the fruits of patriarchy. By articulating the vulnerability black men have faced at the hands of white civilization, the sexual, economic, and racial exploitation they have suffered at the hands of white men and women, it becomes easier to see that the violence black males have suffered exceeds the disciplinary category of masculinity. The black male was defined outside of the world, understanding why and how he engaged this negation should amend our present investments in gender.
where we will conclude for this week. We will pick up next week in Chapter 1, the subheading, Part of the Family, the Modality of the Enslaved. That's for next Thursday. The number 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Folks have commentary, questions on what they heard from the second audio segment. Still, if we have folks who have any thoughts on the comment about black males across all age groups having better life expectancy in greater confinement, I would be interested in hearing any thoughts. If not, thoughts from the second half of the book, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
And yet, this is Carlos from out of New Jersey. Real interesting when we was talking about the life expectancy, comparing black males incarcerated and that's in greater confinement, and that's, you know, that's out in the real world. It's real interesting that you say that, because in my dealings with people, black males who are in and out of jail, it's this thing where when they come out of jail, they have more or less a healthier look. A lot of black males are complimented on just how good they look. And within months, if they haven't, you know, found employment, or if you know, with the stress of life, they immediately lose that fresh out of jail shine, so to speak, you know. And that's just kind of like a going thing of black males who has been incarcerated, and when they basically leave greater confinement. So that's real interesting. And a cousin of mine, and I noticed that, you know, I mean, when he came home, he was vibrant. I mean, skin looked good, was healthy. Within a matter of a year, I ran into him, and he just looked beat down. He just looked stressed out. You know, so it was that's interesting. And when you read about the Macy's worker who was arrested for allegedly robbing intoxicated white female, I can so relate to that. I was at work. I drive trucks. I got into an accident. Black male officer was doing a police report. When he came to my truck, clearly I was in my work uniform. I'm in a commercial vehicle. He asked me, do you have any warrants? I'm like, no, I don't have any warrants. But I was so offended, because I said to myself, would he have asked a white guy that? Or maybe some Mexican guys that was, I was involved in an accident, another commercial vehicle. I was wondering, did he walk to them and ask them if they had warrants? But because of my black maleness, he just assumed maybe I had warrants, even though I was at work at the time. It was just, you know, so I could just relate to what Dr. Curry is talking about in his text.
Much obliged. I had not heard that before, the fresh out of jail shine. I have to make a note to ask Dr. Curry about that, if he's heard that sort of phrasing specifically. Let's see, the person who dialed in 5771, did you have commentary?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. In regards to what the previous male caller had said in regards to the black males or males in prison having a higher the death rates were higher for a population outside of prison compared to them with the same race counterparts in prison. The Khalif Browder story that was mentioned in the reading is a perfect example of that statistic, because Khalif Browder was basically in jail for, 3 years and was beaten and brutalized and starved. And apparently he survived in jail. But then when he got out, he attempted suicide and basically was successful. So, you look at it, and when you're in greater confinement, you're more watched carefully. And obviously they want to try to keep you alive so that they can terrorize you and brutalize you as long as they can. Whereas if you're outside, then you're more likely to be susceptible to a white supremacist, or even to your own self with like Khalif Browder, because the fact that he's been terrorized in prison. And so it's like it kind of stuck out with me with the second reading, and then talking about the part where you're more likely to survive in jail than on the outside. So that's all I have on my mind.
Much obliged. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Feel free. Folks taking time to organize. Yeah.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I'm on starting off. I have the book, so I'm just going back to like 32. Page 32, when they were speaking about the FBI and how they changed the definition of rape and found that in the 12 month span, if I'm correct, I believe it was according to, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it's Stemple and Meyer, that the numbers of women that were raped was like 1 million, 270. And then the numbers for men was 1,000,267. Like, that was amazing. And they said this was a striking find, but it was completely ignored by the Center for Disease Control, which I just find it odd. But I also thank Dr. Curry for putting in the numbers. Like, he's, at the same time, while he's putting in the numbers, he's giving us information basically exposing resources that we could tap into ourselves to find out numbers that we may be curious about, which I think is really great. I'm impressed by that. Also, the France Fanon part, this is on page 35 at the top. He goes into this part where France Fanon's reading here, I believe it's, negrophobic woman is in fact nothing but a punitive sexual partner, just as negrophobic man is a repressed homosexual. And I this makes me want to read back this book. I don't recall some of these lines, but the way he's cueing this together also corresponds, of course, with Dr. Francis Kress Wilson in regards to black males being just considered like walking phallic symbols, but at the same time, physically violent and threatening in the same regard. And because in this paragraph, it goes on, but I don't want to harp on that. I wanted to jump on something else, get onto something else as well. But I do think, as black men, I think we could agree across the board just about how many times per day. I live in New York City. I'm in Brooklyn here, and just getting on the train and even just passing by people, we walk everywhere because the trains are so accessible and bus. So you're constantly seeing people, and whether you realize it or not, it's very important to be aware, because people are constantly constantly have their eyes on you. And it's just a feeling you even feel when you're on the train and you have another eye staring at you, and you look up and you see it might be a white man or a white woman staring at you, observing you to some degree. And even in just greetings at the high-tech plantation I work at, the people, when they see me and have seen me consistently times before, there's no very few people. I could probably count on one hand the amount of people that even give me a smile when they actually see me, as compared to a kind of a snarl and type of a frown, you know. And that is, I mean, it's disheartening from time to time, but it's unfortunately sometimes expected. Going back to the book, there's another aspect that I wanted to touch on that you, and this was very important. This is kind of where you left off. This is on page 42. And this is in regards to patriarchy involved to protect white womanhood, because white womanhood is not only the foundation on which empire is built, but also the, I may pronounce this word incorrect, correct me if I'm wrong, nescience of the expendable white male surplus needed for imperial conquest. She births man, so the white woman is given a peculiar power. And I think that's really important that he points this out, that she is given a peculiar power under white supremacy. This reality is excluded from theory in an effort to maintain the essential category of the woman as morally good and subjectively vulnerable and in need of recognition and preference in discourse. I think that is a very, very important line. And I think that's something that we just constantly miss. And I hear it when I speak to other non-white females, black women, and they deal with, you know, they go on these terms of white male privilege, and they never talk about white women. They leave them completely out of the aspect of the whole process. They leave them off the table as if they're not contributing, if not more than anybody else, to subjugation of us as a people. That was one of the main points I wanted to get across. I have some other ones, but I want to hear other people speak as well. I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Much obliged. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary, lines should be open. Proceed. Folks still taking time. Well, you don't have a whole lot of time, so if you have things that you would like to share, you should get it together. I will share my thoughts to the caller who just shared. I too thought that that was a extraordinarily important portion of the text, certainly of what we read today. Let's see. Kind of what they mentioned, Frederick Jermaine Carter. I had Mr. Carter in the logo for the cows. Way back when, not to devalue his death, but because, from my recollection, no one even heard about Mr. Carter, who was found hanging from a tree at the end of 2010, December. It didn't even cause a whisper, and people talk. That's why I say, when I hear that argument presented that black males get all of this attention when they die, and, you know, that's a part of their black male privilege. Recent, this is, you know, not ancient history, 2010. Frederick Jermaine Carter found hanging from a tree, and it did not generate all kinds of hashtags and hoopla and all of that. Anywho, Dr. Curry, he says, to be a black male is to live in constant fear of being accused of some offense against another. Bill Cosby. Black men live in a world where any accusation against them is thought to be evidence of their guilt. Extremely important, and just to have that as the psychology of how you have to function in the world, the toll that takes on you as a black male. I thought this was so important, and connected to Frederick Jermaine Carter and Michael Brown Jr. and Trayvon Martin and Eric Garner and Philando Castile and Alton Sterling and dot, dot, dot. You can, you know, just continue to add on where he says, whereas the violation of other bodies is thought to be too unsightly to be seen, the dead bodies of black males are circulated, shared, and memed with little hesitation. Many in our society accepted this reality as a norm, but what effects does death have on the lives, the mental concept of the self the black males formulate in this violent world? Really important segment, I thought, something that we've talked about quite a bit on this program. Oh, let's see. Where he talks about the drives and erotic motivations behind white society's desire for black male death. What needs are satisfied by killing the black male, looking upon his corpse? Black men are rarely thought of beyond their dead bodies. What makes them that? The corpse is relatively unknown. The cause of their death is thought simply to be racism and rarely proceeds beyond literally stating this. I've written about that consistently where we'll have Kalief Browder. Incidentally, that's one of the most depressing, really, pieces of evidence to support, I think, a lot of what Dr. Curry's talking about. It's so depressing, the documentary. I think it's like six parts. I think Jay-Z was involved with the financing of some of it, but it's so depressing. But it's like you get all of these different films. They had the one on Trayvon Martin, and it's tons of them. They had the one on Jordan Davis as well, where a black male dies, and now we, you know, come to explore every cranny of their life, and most importantly, how they died. Fruitvale Station, tons of these, and just keep circulating and keep circulating. That's the whole process of worshiping necrophilia, worshiping black death, and in my view, a sexual fetish in indulging in particularly black male death. That's, you know, most of these projects that I just named. Let's see. I thought the, as I said, the sentence that the listener quoted about the peculiar power, didn't use the word privilege, the peculiar power that the white woman has in the system of white supremacy. I think that is so critically important. I think Dr. Curry is one of the few who talks consistently about the fact that whites are not ignorant about racism and the role that white women play in the practice of white supremacy, white terrorism. That's something that we've talked about with him on the program before. Love that he pointed it out there. You cannot have a system of white supremacy without white women. Foundational to the system of white supremacy is white women. Cannot be stated enough. Any other folks have commentary that they want to make sure they get in, question something they didn't understand, question they would like to submit to Dr. Curry? Again, I'm sure he would be willing to help.
Ivy here?
Yes, ma'am. Ivy.
I just wanted to quickly say I missed a lot of the second portion, unfortunately, so I'll have to go back and listen. I just wanted to say about, you know, what I said earlier in terms of the intellectuality of the different books that I named, and I noticed that you seem to disagree with that assessment, and I completely understand that, because it could certainly be just me, because ultimately when I look at your academic credentials in school and out of school, and just even the way that you talk, I consider you to be an intellectual and someone whose level that I'm not on. So the way that I struggled with the books that I named could be just me, and the average person may not struggle with them the way that I did. So my assessment could be completely incorrect, but that's just kind of what I thought. And so that was it. Thanks, Gus.
Which books did you say you thought were kind of a struggle to read?
Some more than others, but at the top of the list would be one of them that you mentioned, Yerugu, and this one that we're listening to right now. I struggle with Dr. Welsing, but again, not as much as this one. Struggle with Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow, but again, not as much as this one. Whereas for me, a lay person, I'm a lay person type. I'm not really the intellectual type. And Black Love is a Revolutionary Act or books like that, like those are like to me lay person type of books. They're not like academic like these to me. And so those type of books I don't struggle with. I don't struggle with those type of books, but you know, the ones that I named with Dr. Curry and all those other people, I struggle with those, and again, some more than others. Did that answer your question?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, good.
Yurugu was difficult for Gus as well. That was not an easy read for me. I've read it more than once now, but at no point in life where I read that book that I think it was easy. I don't exactly think the ISIS Papers is the easiest book as well. But yeah, this is definitely a challenging book. All three of those are The Man Not, ISIS Papers, Yurugu. None of those are easy books to read. None of them. I think you probably need a good dictionary and might need to reread pages of the book to make sure that you understand it. Other folks have commentary they wanted to make sure they get in.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
On Ivy's point, my highest level of education is a master's degree, and I struggle reading this book. So I think this will be a struggle to read. And this is my third time reading this book, and I'm still uncovering a lot of things in this book. So, I think almost anybody would, you know, struggle with this book, you know, from my perspective, and especially, you know, non-white black people, you know, especially us being confused in the system of white supremacy. So that's all I have up in my line.
Thank you for sharing that, sir. Incidentally, I did want to point out, we were supposed, or if I had my druthers and I had just made a executive decision, as they say, we would have read Frantz Fanon's White Skin, Black Skin, White Mask, which was quoted in the text, the Negrophobic Woman, the passage I think one of the listeners mentioned. That was the book that I wanted to read of Fanon, but listeners unanimously selected Wretched of the Earth, which formerly was the worst book I ever read. That is a difficult book to read, but it's difficult and not even coherent. This, I think, is a challenging book, but it is very coherent. You can follow this. You might have to look up a word from time to time. If you have to narrate, it might be difficult in terms of pronunciation of some of the words, but I think you can track. It's coherent, what he's saying. At least I found it to be. If it ends up being difficult to understand what's being said, then definitely make a note of that, and maybe we can present that to Dr. Curry. Black people had some difficulty processing what it is that you had to say. Anything else folks want to make sure they get in?
Quickly, I agree with what you just said, Gus. That's it on me, my life.
Right on.
Gus, can I add something else?
Let's hear it.
That I got from the text. It's making more sense now why they go out their way to omit the sexual violence that black males went through during chattel slavery. And I'm assuming that's because they're trying to push this narrative, as Dr. Curry states, of some kind of black male patriarchy that really doesn't exist. That's all I had to add.
Much obliged. I think for most of those books, the ISIS Papers, Yurugu, The Man Not, I think you get more out of them as you study. It's like a good movie. You can watch it more than once. Good book, constructive information. Sometimes you might have to read the whole book more than once to really extract constructive information. And you'll even learn more. Invisible Man, I've forgotten how many times I've read that book. I did want to add also, the information about the life expectancy for black males in greater confinement as opposed to black males that are not in greater confinement, I thought that really emphasized why Mr. Fuller says even the use of the term greater confinement, that we're all in prison, if you're going to do, if you're going to have that fresh out of jail shine as a result of being locked up and, you know, whatever is happening there. And then you come out and it's, oh, man, I'm being beat down and terrible now that I'm out. We are all in prison. Just some of us have a bit more room to move around than others. That really emphasized. And in fact, a whole lot of this emphasized what Mr. Fuller said. Dr. Curry given a different set of logic as to why black males and females do not qualify for man, woman. We will rest there. We'll be back next week picking up in Chapter 1, Dr. Curry's The Man Knot. We'll be here tomorrow. Looking forward, hopefully Thomas in New York will be safe. We'll be able to hear what happened that prompted in some sort of brawl or violence, counter-violence with a race soldier that seemed to be work-related. 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Hope you are taking care of yourself. Man, I can't even imagine the amount of stress if it had to get to that level. That is a horrible day on the plantation. Self-care. For everybody, but especially Thomas in New York. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Race soldiers have thoroughly exploited many of us who were not thinking correctly. And even that intoxicated white woman practicing racism, we would be best to be sober so that we can make phenomenal decisions to try to keep ourselves as safe as possible. In addition to being sober, if we could remain buckled up each and every time we are in a vehicle, sober, buckled, driver, or passenger, let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.